know, Jeff, I sent...
The Tuesday, October 1st meeting of the Planning and Development Committee of Council. And first order of business is approval of the minutes. If I could have a motion.
Move for approval.
Okay, we have a motion and a second for approval of minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, minutes are approved. Next are public comments. Is there anyone who would like to make a public comment? If you would please come to the podium, and you have 2 minutes to talk about what you wish.
Hi, I'm Laura Fox. I reside at 1507 Plover Avenue in Casina Heights, and I'm here in regards to the school acquiring the lot that's on Hill Road. And we went before a zoning committee, and they sort of deferred it until this meeting today. We are all pleased that the school is going to utilize this lot for extending their turn lane and taking traffic off of Rifle Range. Our only concern is the impact that it'll make in our neighborhood. So already we're dealing with a lot of bicycles and cars and golf carts. So they have made a plan which allows for a dedicated bike access and golf cart access, which is going to be great for the kids and their safety. So we're fine with that access occurring off of Hill Road to get them off of Rifle Range, but we don't want any other vehicular traffic or a curb cut that would be coming through our neighborhood. So our attendance today is simply to say we're happy with the zoning and we support it. But we'd like to have some sort of confidence with you that if the school ends up not using this land or if it gets developed several years down the road, we want to make sure there's not an impact on our neighborhood. And we'd like to be a part of that planning process to make sure there's a sufficient buffer, just a vegetative buffer, so we're not seeing in our neighborhood all of that.
What committee did you say you went to?
Zoning. So the zoning committee.
Planning commission. Ah, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't making work here. All right.
In order for the school to acquire the land, they have to have the rezoning to take it into the...
Got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Okay.
If you would give us your name and address in a couple of minutes, please.
My name is Eddie Twilley. I live at 228 Indigo Bay Circle. I'm here today to speak on the Hudson Back Bay Village. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Homeowners Association Board of Directors. We feel like Back Bay Village has got about 45, 50 homes, and we've got a number, Hill Road is our primary access road to and from the community to Rifle Range, and we got a number of students who go there. So we think that the school district's plan to extend their pickup drop-off is prudent. But like the previous speaker, we have a little bit of concern about some of that, and that's what we'd like today. I understand that you have the ability possibly to put stipulations on your decision about whether to annex this property or not. So what I'm going to be doing is, I don't know, conditions or whatever, but let me just say, and I have a list that I'll leave with you, is that number one is no new entrance or exits off of Hill Road. That's something we've been interested in, since the school was constructed. And, we generate traffic on that road. We have a number of students who either walk, bike, or come by golf cart to the pedestrian entrance, the bike entrance there on Hill Road. It creates sort of a congested area down there. And we worried about if you have any more traffic coming in and out of Hill Road, that we'd put those students and parents and families at greater risk. When we met with the school district, and we thank them for that, we talked about that congestion. They agreed to provide some a pickup drop-off for golf carts and bicycles on this subject property, and that's to ensure safety so the kids don't have to cross that expanded loop. So we want to make sure that that's included.
You're just about out of time, sir. You could wrap it up, or if you have a list, you could leave it with our planning director.
Good. The final thing is that if your decision, you know, if the school board for some reason doesn't purchase the property, we'd like to see it revert back to low density residential one. Because if we go into planned development, we understand we may have less opportunity to input into what may go on that property. So we'd like to be have it to go through a full rezoning if it's necessary on that. So be happy to answer any questions that you might have. And I'll leave these recommendations.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Lee, how you doing?
I'm good. How about y'all?
I'm doing good.
Lee Gastly with Seaman Whiteside and Associates, 1881 Capri Drive, Charleston. We're acting as a consultant for the Charleston County School District. I'll just reiterate what the previous speaker said. We had a very good meeting last Thursday at the school with a number of residents from the community. Talked about what their desires were for access to that property. The plan, and I think staff will show that during the time on the agenda, will show that we're addressing both the drop-off with golf carts, which currently kind of occurs all along that length. We're kind of going to provide a separate access for golf carts with a parking area actually on the property, try to pull them off the road. We're also going to relocate where the pedestrian access is to pull it further from the intersection of Rifle Range and Hale, so there's no crossing at all of the drop-off area. So we're trying to promote safety through that. As far as some of the other conditions that were mentioned, I mean, certainly there's no intention to, you know, provide a curb cut for ingress, egress for cars or anything like that. I think the plan will show that. We're fine with the buffer. Actually, the way the plan's drawn right now, there's probably 40 to 50 feet of natural buffer left between where the drive would be and the road. I don't think that there's any condition that's been mentioned that the district would necessarily have any problem with. So we're available to answer any questions when it comes back up.
Great. Thanks,
Lee. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to?
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Hey.
Hi. If you would give us your name and address in 2 minutes, please.
Sure. Linda Balzac. I'm president of the Residents Association in Hobcaw, and my address is 422 Hobcaw Drive. And I'm here to represent the neighborhood. The Hobcaw Point Residents Association would like to have their electrical service secured by burying the power lines all the way back to the service connection tap at the best main electrical feed. I have three main points to address: beautification, reliability, and cost effectiveness. As you are aware, our neighborhood streets resemble smaller versions of oak-canopied scenic roads. Positioned on a peninsula bordered by the Wando River and Hobcaw Molasses Creek, electrical service is provided from a tap off of the Mathis Ferry feed using overhead power lines running down Muirhead Road. Any disruption in these lines, and there have been many, creates a massive blackout to 383 households in our neighborhood, not to mention those in Ion and in Molasses. We request that in order to make this happen, the following primary actions need to happen. The Mathis Ferry Power Line Burial Project needs to continue, and most importantly, the project be slightly expanded to include the Muirhead Road electrical feeder line that services Ion, Molasses Creek, and Hobcaw. We request that the town approve and fund a Dominion Energy engineering study to determine costs and other project elements associated with burying overhead electrical lines in Hobcaw. Please keep in mind that our neighborhood puts $50,000 per year into this franchise fee fund. As additional incentive, there is an agreement with Dominion Energy that funding for these types of activities are equally matched by them. I've prepared a package for you today, which you just received. The purpose in our documentation is to assist the town in creating a program for other older communities that face this challenge, communities left behind by our explosive urban sprawl. We encourage you to take us on as your pilot group in creating this opportunity for these communities. We have collected 341 signatures so far, and these are the petitions I have, just to show you. And our neighborhood is all about this. We put these in everybody's mailbox, and they actually signed them and went to a neighbor's other box in the neighborhood to put it. So very enthusiastic about this program. And we're a tight-knit group, and they really want to keep abreast of this, and we're going to put any updates on our website. And I just want this to happen. And to every problem, there's a solution. Okay. So that is what makes our town great. Thank you for hearing us today, and please consider the future welfare of our neighborhood as well as those that surround us.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you for letting me publicly speak. I don't like it.
Thank you.
Is this on mute? This is not mute.
Well, we're going to be talking to Dominion, and there's some... Well, this is, could go to... Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to... yes, sir. If you would give us your name and address in a couple of minutes, please.
Thank you. My name is Robert Irvin. I'm the owner of Irvin's Auto Repair and Tow Service, and I'm here just concerning the rezoning of my automobile repair shop at 1190 Shadow Drive. I've been in Mount Pleasant and doing business here now for 41 years. My business is currently zoned OP, and I'm here to update and correct that zoning to AB2. My business is an automobile repair shop with outside storage for vehicles. This business is operated this way for the 41 years I've been here. In fact, the business has served the Mount Pleasant community and operated on the Mount Pleasant tow rotation this 41 years. And I'm here to answer any questions that anybody might have of me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Do we have anyone else? Going once? Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming today. That concludes public comments. So with that, we'll turn it over to you, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. First item is an annexation request for your consideration. It is at 4586 Cape Island Drive. It's two-thirds of an acre. The comprehensive plan recommends rural conservation land uses in this particular location, and it would be assigned an RC Rural Conservation District zoning category if annexed and zoned. The appraised value of a single-family, it's appraised, and you see the amount there, and it is an existing single-family residence being requesting to become part of the town. And our staff has communicated not only with this property owner but others in the area who may also be anticipating submitting similar annexation petitions. This is in an area known as Paradise Island, so it's on the other side of the Wando River at the northern end of town. This particular property you see here outlined, there's again the comprehensive plan designation for rural, and all of the property cross-hatched is in unincorporated county.
How do they tie in with the annexation rules? Doesn't there have to be the touching a part of the town?
The contiguity is handled through the sort of, collapse the boundaries of the river. So there are specific requirements that we would follow and look at. So when you have things like roads or dividers like that, you sort of collapse the middle, and they are considered then contiguous.
What obligations would this put on our public services if this one tract comes in, it's across the river, it's not surrounded by any sort of town at all?
We've got, anticipating that kind of question, planning ahead, we've got some additional information and slides that may get to that, Ms. Whitley. So here is sort of an the largest scale view, a little tougher to see here, but the lighter on an aerial photo, sort of the lighter green areas are existing corporate limits for the town. The gold is unincorporated county, Awandaw there to your right. You'll see it better in a second. This is just zooming in a little bit closer on this particular location with the Wando running through the middle. On the comprehensive plan map, this is where you can see the jurisdictional map. The bright green is Town of Mount Pleasant. Yellow areas are still unincorporated. So you see this particular area on the other side in this general, in this vicinity. And this next slide just brings that in a little bit closer for you to see the varying jurisdictions throughout here with Forest Service, Charleston County, City of Charleston to the west, northwest. So we did want to give you this sort of overview and believe that this request, potentially others, and interest in annexing any additional area in this area does have some implications for the town as sort of an overall policy question. And I think the more we're going to add to that.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead then?
Okay. So, excellent question, Ms. Whitley. The area of the annexation is known as Paradise Island. And you see how it's, you see the lots just north of the green area, which represents Mount Pleasant. And then following it, I guess, more towards the center of the page and higher is what's known as Cat Island, which currently doesn't have access, bridge access. The way to service the area is if we can go back with the cursor, Jeff,
mm-hmm.
you have to go up Highway 17, take Gerrans Bridge Road right up there, and then come down Woodville Road to get to Paradise Island. We have a few properties, if you go back to the right, Jeff, that are across the river that are in the town of Mount Pleasant, and we have limited service provision there, meaning when it comes to trash pickup, we send one of those smaller vehicles that just picks up one or two at a time. But obviously, a growth in town properties in Paradise Island would require additional services, which would require an expansion at a minimum, a few extra hours every week for the collection of trash and garbage. I believe in last discussions with our chief, it's almost the distance of 10 miles to the nearest town fire station. Now, there's a county fire station being built in that proximity. Police services, same type of thing. We have expanded into an 8th district into that area, but it's a larger district. There's not a lot of activity. It would require a reshaping of our district and likely additional personnel because we wouldn't be satisfied with the response times if we had to respond to a situation out there. So from a service delivery perspective, to service one or two or even a half dozen homes probably doesn't make a lot of sense for the town. The other side of the coin is, and this is a policy discussion at the council level, is that, can you zoom out a little bit? Where do you want to draw the line as far as the growth of the community? To not grow means you're static. But to grow would require a movement into this area. And also could potentially block another jurisdiction from moving into that area, which would block off Mount Pleasant from growth potential forever. With council support, we made a significant move in protecting future citizens of Mount Pleasant, their interest, when we were able to successfully annex Bulls Bay. And that means that all of the properties closer to town, Mount Pleasant, that are in the county can't be reached by another jurisdiction in one day, or they could choose to stay into Charleston County, or if they wanted more services, they would be forced to annex into the town because there would be no other jurisdictions I could offer it. So that's really the crux of the matter. On one hand, it doesn't make much sense from a service delivery standpoint. It's a money loser for us in the short term. But the conversation needs to be had on the strategy and the strategic approach of how the town wants to handle growth going into the future. I would suggest that if you and council were inclined to at some point move town services into this area and expand the growth of the community, that it be with some type of package deal with the property owners out there. It can't just be one or two at a time. It'd have to be entire community which, you know, we can't do on our own because of the annexation laws. It'd have to be an entire community, perhaps a discussion with the owner of Cat Island. What you can be sure of, I suspect, is any discussions with property owners to bring these areas into the town would be met with a discussion on density requirements. The density allowances in that area are low. But I can bet that the property owners who still have land remaining would want at least the same, if not greater, density. So very difficult from a public policy perspective. I think I laid out as best I could. The last part of all this is any expansion does protect the citizens of Mount Pleasant and future generations.
From what?
It protects future generations of Mount Pleasant residents, because by moving into the areas, you're allowing other jurisdictions who could determine their own density requirements. You're preventing them from doing that.
Gotcha.
So you could end up coming back saying maybe in the short term it doesn't make sense financially for the town. However, in order for the reasons I just mentioned, it's in the best strategic interest of the town to take a loss in the short term in order to protect future generations and the ability of the town to grow.
Have we gone out and talked to the rest of the community about annexation using either the 25% method or 75% method, whichever would be appropriate? No?
Nope.
You know, I feel it's tough to annex one and then stretch services for police, fire, and sanitation about 10 miles to come back, but it may make sense to have an effort just as we did with other parts of towns. Whitehall, if you remember, they had an election and the whole area came in. This may be something where we use one of those methods to try to get all of those residents to come in. Yes, sir.
I agree with the need for the discussion and the larger policy decisions. Today, right now, we have an annexation in front of us, a request. I'll move for denial and for the denial of the request and hopefully have those discussions and those things that you're talking about before.
Can we defer this?
Yes.
Until we have...
Was Mr. O'Rourke making a motion?
Mr. O'Rourke made a motion, but there was no second.
So are we saying that the motion has failed then?
I'm fine with that.
Interrupting the whole, we're fine.
Yeah.
We can defer it for a
to answer
of
your
time.
Question. My question was, could we defer this until we have, and I don't know if the property owner wants to defer it, if that will cause some heartburn with him. However, I think we do need to have the conversation with the whole neighborhood, if possible, and so that there's some economy scale in here for doing this. Because I think it's going to be tough to run all those services out 10 miles for one house.
Okay. Sir, perhaps in the next month, if we need more time, we'll let you know. We can communicate with not just the resident, the applicant here, but also others in the area and see what the potential is for perhaps a larger group of property owners who may be wishing to annex.
Okay. Would a defer? Yes, ma'am.
And then I was wondering if we could also maybe have an item on the agenda that talks about the broader overall policy of these kinds of annexations. You toss off, well, we're surrounded by water on, you know, one side and the forest on the other. Like, there's nowhere else to go. But if what we're hearing here is that there are places to go, what, basically, are we kind of in competition with Awandaw to, like, get things? Or is that, yes?
Okay. In this area,
or Charleston.
And in this case, possibly Charleston.
Who's there on that side?
Yeah, because water can't prohibit contiguity.
Okay.
So if they can make an argument that it's aligned, then they could move into Cat Island, which then could allow them into Paradise Island. But, yes, we are in competition, and I don't mean it in a, you know, in a revenue way. I mean, this really is a protective mechanism. Ideally, and hope you allow me to say this, that I think you'd want to be in a position to give Mount Pleasant citizens and residents the opportunity to control their destiny.
Absolutely.
And not have it controlled by
the outside kind of encroaching towards us. And then also their alignment or their goals with density may be different than ours.
Yes.
And so then we could end up with things kind of on the edge of our town that impact our town and our roads and our traffic.
But this one is different than our sort of general annexation approach, because in general we have the donut holes in town that you know of, and really that comes down to continuity of service, you know, making sure it's clear where fire trucks and police cars are to go and not to go, and fairness in taxation. That's really our approach for every other part of town. This is a different story.
Yeah, I would love to see something like this for next month that talks about, I guess, kind of at the bleeding edge of wherever, you know, I mean, I thought there wasn't really anywhere to go, so that's kind of interesting, and maybe if there's information in the comprehensive plan that speaks to that, that would be also interesting to see.
Sure. 60 days, 90 days?
If 60 days, if we can be back sooner and you're comfortable with it on the agenda, we'll do that.
Okay.
I can remove my motion.
Okay, it's already died for lack of second.
Already gone?
Yep.
Okay.
But we can, if there was a motion for deferral for 60 days
I'll make that motion for
I'll
deferral.
Second that.
Okay. And then if we have a motion and a second, but if we can, if you can get that information sooner,
yes.
Bring it back, we'll put it on there. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. There may be some interesting discussions to fall out of that we'll have to have some go to Ms. Whitley's point about, you know, where the goose egg stops.
Sir.
Okay.
Next item, we're picking back up on recommendations from the Planning Commission from the August meeting. This is a set of text amendments related to the Old Village Historic District and the Old Village Historic District Commission. These amendments, some of initially generated by the commission itself, and we'll talk about a couple of those, and then staff with the opportunity to look at a whole zoning district used it as a way to say, are there improvements, cleanups. Mr. Rutherford, Austin Rutherford, handles, he's the liaison to the commission, and so on a day-to-day basis is working with our existing regulations, property owners, and the commission, and has identified a number of improvements that we could make. So they range from major and minor ones. We'll cover those. The major changes that we wanted to point out, one is the idea that we may want to consider changing the name, not specifically calling it the Old Village Historic District Commission, but making it more generic, and then having a Historic District Preservation Commission for the entire community, anticipating, again, some of the recommendations in the draft comprehensive plan is that we might want to consider other historic areas, so you wouldn't want to have the Old Village Historic District dealing with other parts of the community in this particular topic. So that's sort of a neutral, generic way of addressing that particular issue, and we'll talk a minute about how other districts could be created. The other major change is, if you're familiar with the code as it stands today, we have a fixed date that we consider properties historic, having been built before 1936. So it doesn't roll. So our stock and supply of historic structures and features is static. Most communities, the National Register, the Secretary of Interior in the U.S., Interior Department handles historic districts. Most communities have this as a rolling period. So as time moves on, you would expect that more structures and properties and areas would become historic. Ours doesn't. So we're looking at one particular point in time. So this recommendation, one of the primary ones from the commission, would be to consider moving it to a rolling 50-year before whatever year we're in. And we've identified here structures like Pitt Street Pharmacy and our own Alhambra Hall would then be able to be considered under this, whereas today they wouldn't be. How we go about designating historic properties is, this particular ordinance amendment. On the left, you see sort of our schedule, and we're actually here at Planning Committee on October the 1st. But these set of ordinance amendments would have to be acted upon first. And then Austin has identified the potential of another almost 200 structures that may qualify for historic designation based on the rolling age within the boundaries of the district itself. And then we'd have to be able to do more work. So action now on the amendments wouldn't do anything immediately to make additional designations of those properties.
Yeah, but are we still talking about only the areas
within covered by the old village boundary today?
Which would be Royal Street to the harbor, basically.
Yes.
Okay, what if you go across, because this now makes buildings built in 69, if my math is correct, in 1969, eligible to be considered historic. We have right across Royal Street structures that go back to 50s. If this rolling thing, I mean, are we looking at expanding that?
That's another consideration. That's not what we're proposing here. Right now it's using the existing boundary that you see, but another consideration could be expanding the boundaries of this particular historic district. That's something that's recommended in the comprehensive plan as a potential area to look at, but that's not what we're dealing with right now. So we're working on those fixed boundary, changing the timing so that additional structures may be identified as historic.
Yes, ma'am.
Is the desire to move to more neutral name and expand and basically or create new districts, historic districts, is that an effort to preserve settlement communities?
That could be part of that consideration, yes.
And is that something that we could potentially offer to settlement communities, like as an option to encourage them to annex into the town?
That could be a consideration,
okay.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, if we moved like that, even Liz's house could become historic. 1958, there you go.
And then the other component of this is talking about any future districts. This is a long process. Again, it doesn't happen instantly. So the commission itself would then be able to say, working with an area, we believe this area of town should be considered a new historic district. And then there's a whole procedure that one would go through, surveys, identifying what the characteristics are of that new district would be, and then being able to put that in place. But that's a longer-term consideration, but we want to make it clear that what we're focusing on now is really within the district itself. And Austin can cover some of the specific pieces.
Good morning. So along with those major pieces, we do have some notable minor revisions to go over. So as of right now, accessory structures in Old Village are limited to 1.5 stories. However, we've never had a definition of a half story. In addition to Old Village, we also have a half story talked about in many of our PDs. We've just never had what constitutes a half story. So working with or looking at other communities that do have a half story, as well as making sure that it works with our own building inspections division, we came up with this new definition. Some jurisdictions have a half story is 40% the floor, some is 60%. We just made it basic, it's 50%. So if you have a 500 foot first story, you get 250 upstairs. Also together, making sure that we don't get these pseudo half stories like on the right. making sure that the floor plane of the first of the top of the first floor meets up with the edge of the roof. So that would be making sure that we only get what's on the left. Another major issue is really getting into the intention of what the impervious lot coverage and the building area ratio were meant to do in Old Village. Right now, it just specifies, oh, it's 40% for impervious coverage of the entire lot, 50% for BAR of the entire lot. But that was really never the intention because we do have, we have parcels that have king's rights, so up to, as you can see on the right, 50% of the lot is marsh, it's harbor. So technically those properties can use marsh harbor to get a bigger home, more impervious surface. So potentially that's an approximation of what they could potentially pave over, if you will. And that was never the intention, so it's really closing that loophole from anyone potentially being able to use it.
So it defines a buildable area?
Yes. So it'll be defined as anything within the critical line. So anything outside the critical line you can't use for more square footage for the home or more impervious surface.
Got it.
Going further, as of right now, the code only states that accessory structures are limited to the rear of the property, rear of the structure. However, with many homes, you have dual frontage. You have your road in the back. You have, marsh or the harbor on the other side. So it's really trying to close up those gaps. So, for instance, if you just had a normal home with street frontage in the front, you have your accessory structure in the back. But say if you had a double coverage lot, as I explained, you got to situate that accessory structure more to the interior, more in keeping with the line of the main structure. As of right now, a professional on the commission is not exactly warranted or rather required. This text amendment would make a person in architecture history, planning, one of those fields that is pertinent to be on the commission, to be mandatory on the commission. That falls in line with the design review board, which you have to have an architect, landscape architect, and so on. Also, increasing the review time from currently it's at 2 weeks to 4 weeks. This will not only allow more review time for staff to make sure that our staff report is good and everything falls in line, that we have a proper amount of time, but also will allow an extra week for the properties to be signed. So I've gotten a couple complaints, I was on vacation, I didn't see those signs out. This will just allow for another week, so hopefully we can, anyone that travels down there can be able to see the signs, see what's going on. In retrospect, these are the major and minor changes. There are some even, very minute changes for, punctuation and other type stuff. But these are the brunt of what we're getting in this text amendment. So we've gone through the house story definition, commission name change, method of calculating the BAR and lot coverage, all these specifics. But if there are any other changes that you propose, this has been recommended by both the commission and planning commission. Unfortunately, the chair and vice chair weren't able to make it today, but they have voiced previously their enthusiasm for the changes.
I think, can I move to recommend approval of this to full council?
Certainly.
I do.
Okay. Second.
Okay, we have a motion second to recommend full council the approval of these changes. Okay. So we have a motion, a second, any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Recommend approval. Just as an aside, as we start looking at this, what's historic, Mount Pleasant going back to the 50s and early 60s, the town boundary was Ben Sawyer Boulevard. So, you know, there may be some sense there in doing that, because as we get older, we get older.
That doesn't happen.
That was very profound, wasn't it?
That was. That was really good.
Okay. Let's go on to five. Oh, I haven't seen you since short-term rentals.
Oh, you missed me, didn't you?
Well, I thought maybe you got time off.
I should have. No. Just happy to be here. And not talking about short-term rentals. Okay, so our first request before you is, you heard from the applicant during the public comment period. It's at 1190 Shadow Drive, and you can see it here. So you've got Chuck Dolly Boulevard, you've got Bowman up there, and then I think it backs up to Hickory Shadows. I think that's the neighborhood. And so you can see here, future land use is the urban quarter land uses. And then it's the one with the star. So it's zoned office professional. And the request is to rezone to AB2, Area-Wide Business 2 District, and to maintain the current Boulevard Overlay District zoning. Mr. Irvine has operated his automobile service and repair shop there more than 40 years, so it predates our 1979 zoning code. And so if he were to come in today and request this type of use, he would need the AB2 zoning, which is actually adjacent to him. It's the same type of use, and they came in a couple years ago and rezoned to AB2. And so he just wants to make his use conforming. And actually what it would require with any sort of outdoor storage of vehicles is if the use went away, if it was destroyed, or if he were to come in today and request the use as a new use, not only would he need AB2, but he would need to get a special exception through the Board of Zoning Appeals. And so as he exists today, if he gets the rezoning, he'll be conforming to the zoning. But should he change anything or make major improvements, he would need to go through and get that special exception. So he just wants to make his zoning conforming to the use that's been there for over 40 years. And there's an aerial. And Planning Commission did recommend approval unanimously. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Does the Boulevard Overlay District, with the extras that it adds onto there, does that allow the?
No, because the Boulevard Overlay expands permitted uses, but only up to AB. In order to do AB2 uses, the underlying has to specifically be AB2. And so this rezoning is required to make that use.
Move to approve.
Legal.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. One question when you go back to that slide.
Yes, sir. Right there?
Is that a exquisite creations by Michelle?
It's not me.
What is that?
I presumably it's a home-based business that showed up on Google Maps. Oh, we get okay. A lot of those, actually. Yeah. If you go to Google Maps, you can see where all a lot of home-based businesses are. Okay. Legal or not legal, I don't know.
Michelle's creation is going to be a letter.
Hey, unless somebody's complaining, I don't. Formal complaint. Okay, this one it's going to be a little more convoluted. I'll try to make it simple. In 2004, the Oakland PD was formed, and the town side ordinance allowed each parcel to have one 35-by-8-foot-tall standing sign. There have been subsequent amendments in 2009 and 2011 for the Oakland PD, specifically pertaining to their signage exhibit. And so they are back today requesting to amend their Oakland PD sign again to specifically address their signage. And so I'll get into that in just a minute.
Lowe's wants to put a 150-foot square foot sign on Highway 70.
It's not Lowe's. It's going to be for the new Taco Bell, which is adjacent to the Lowe's.
It's at the
It's at the other end, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's so the star is on the Lowe's signage here, or the side of Lowe's, so right here. But Taco Bell is here, and I'll get into in a minute why they actually can't put it here. And I don't know if the applicant's here or not, but he can talk more about it. But basically, there's wetlands here. And so while they would be, if they were just a standalone business, zoned AB, they would be able to have a monument sign out there. They can't put it there because of the wetlands. What they want to do, and if you're familiar with that area, I'll actually go down to it. The Lowe's sign, I superimposed it in front of the Lowe's. So that's what it looks like right now, and that's in front of the Lowe's. And if you look, go by there today, there's a Taco Bell sign right underneath the Lowe's. But it's pretty far in front of the entrance to the Taco Bell. And so what they would like to do is keep it on the Lowe's property, because they can't put it on their separate parcel because of those wetlands. But it would be further down, closer to their entrance. And so you can kind of see where they would like to go around right there. They would like to have a sign. So it would be an additional sign. So actually what's before you today, I kind of got ahead of myself. What's before you today is to do three things. To add this additional 150-square-foot sign, which would be primarily for Taco Bell, although Lowe's may have an area underneath because it is on Lowe's property. And then also there are two signs that are along this stretch that were never part of the approved signage exhibit, and that's for the that's these two signs here. So it's the KOA and then the Charleston Fun Park. So those two signs exist right now. They were legally established and they were permitted through the county, but they were never part of this approved signage exhibit in the PD. So what they want to do today is clean it up, be able to add the 150-square-foot signage for Taco Bell, and then make these two signs for the KOA and for Charleston Fun Park part of the official signage exhibit, because if there was something to come along today and wipe those signs out, they wouldn't be able to put them back. So that's the request before you.
On South Morgan Creek Road, there's a sign on the back side. Is that included in the square footage and everything?
Yeah, I mean, all the signage that exists there today is part of the approved PD, except for the two up front that I just mentioned, the KOA and the Charleston Fun Park. So all I'm talking about, there's 11 signs for the Oakland Plan Development along Highway 17. I didn't talk about the one along Porsche Bluff or the internal signs because those are kind of separate, and those are allowed as well. But over the years, certain PD amendments have allowed additional signage than what may be allowed by the town sign ordinance. And so everything that's there is established through a PD amendment, except for the two that they would like to make part of the exhibit and then the additional one they're requesting today.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm comfortable with the two that are already there to kind of bring them in because they were approved by the county, and you know this is just about replacement of what's already there.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, addition of another 150-foot sign when the Taco Bell's already advertising on the Lowe's big sign just seems unnecessary. And if we don't approve 100, like what is approved for them? Like what sign can they put on Lowe's if it's not?
Well, Lowe's already has their sign, and so they're good. But for Taco Bell, so under the town's current sign ordinance, the entire market at Oakland would be allowed to have. It's looked at as a shopping center. But if you were to have Taco Bell standalone, they would be allowed to have the 35 square foot, 8 foot tall. But they can't do it on their separate parcel, A, because of the wetlands, and B, because they're part of the PD, which has its own signage plan.
And they have 11 signs?
So right now there are 11 signs along the stretch of Highway 17.
So was Taco Bell asking for, I mean, the item in the agenda says additional 150 square
right.
feet, but you're saying more like
35 square? No.
No, you had asked what would be allowed just under the town's ordinance.
Gotcha. So if Tuckerville tomorrow wanted to put up a sign, they could put up an 8-foot tall Taco
35 square foot. Square. Correct.
They want 150.
They are requesting 150. Now, they mentioned at Planning Commission that they, the Oakland PD signage exhibit has three sizes of signs, 50, 150, and 200 square feet. Every sign along there is either 50, 150, or 200 square feet. They don't necessarily want to go 150, but they knew they needed more than 50. So they chose the 150. They didn't want to create a new size of a sign to go into this exhibit, adding a fourth size. So they're asking for the 150, but they indicated at Planning Commission that they likely would not go to 150, but they are anticipating that while they'll be the primary sign, Lowe's, because it's on Lowe's property, would perhaps like to have additional signage underneath.
I guess, so the one question I have is, let's say Taco Bell goes away and we make an agreement to accommodate this today and a new business comes in later.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that our approval that we had now stands for that site?
Whatever, yeah, I mean, Taco Bell's there, but when the signage exhibit came through, I don't think it was anticipated that there would be a business at that end.
Right.
And so there's not an allowance for signage down at that end. And that's what Planning Commission discussed, and they actually recommended unanimously approval of it. They wanted to make sure Taco Bell, as a business in the town of Mount Pleasant, had proper signage, because there is an issue with how far up it is. It's close to Lowe's entrance, and so, you know, you get a lot of traffic going by, and they miss it. And so that was Planning Commission's rationale for their decision to recommend approval. But the signage that far down in the development wasn't initially considered when the signage exhibit first came through. So.
Most people go down South Morgan Street Road, make the right, and go around that little point and come in on the South Morgan Street side where there's a sign. They don't turn off of Highway 17 into the Taco Bell. They go to I think they've got enough, but anyway.
Yeah, is there a way to partially approve for those two existing signs and then deny the 150? Is there a way for them to come back to us with a more reasonable request? Because, I mean, we hear this all the time, like, mm-hmm. Oh, just approve this zoning, and we promise we're going to build X, and then we can't actually enforce that, and they can build Y and Z. So with this sign thing, they may promise that they don't want 150, but the nature of asking for 150 means that that's a possibility,
sure.
Not just for them now, but into the future. And so I'm not comfortable. I mean, can we divert?
It's a PD amendment, and so you can condition it, like Jeff said. You could split it. You could place a condition on it. Absolutely.
Okay.
So should we make a motion at this time?
If you have a motion. Did you want to make a motion to approve those?
The two existing. I make a motion to approve the change to include the two existing signs, but I want to deny the 150 and ask them to come back to the town with a more reasonable request.
Okay, well, let's handle those.
Separately?
Separately.
Okay, well, yeah. I move to approve the two signs that are already existing.
Okay, that's the two legal non-existing signs.
That's right.
Make them conform.
All right, I'll second that.
Numbers, yeah.
9 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. 9 and 10. Okay, we have a motion to make the non-conforming signs conforming, 9 and 10.
Yeah.
And a second. Do we have any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay.
And then I guess we don't have to make a motion, but if you could just go back to the Taco Bell folk and say, come back.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have a recommendation for what size you'd like to see, or just have them come up with a different size?
No, I.
Well, what? And they're currently allowed an 8-foot tall sign.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I mean, I'm kind of okay with that.
No, I think that, yeah.
I don't think we should try to decide what type of sign they should come back to us with.
Yeah.
I think we should have them come back and have those approvals, and then we approve or disapprove.
Okay.
Okay. Well, then there's no need for motion.
Right.
Ball's in their court.
Okay.
Hale Road, Raffle Range Road.
Okay. This is a request to amend the Central Mount Pleasant plan development for to bring in an adjacent tract, 1.99 acres, and you can see there it's the smaller tract right here. And so when you heard folks during public comment talking about Hill Road, here's Hill Road, and then here's Rifle Range, and here's Whitesides Elementary. And so the request is to bring this tract in and rezone it from R1 to the Central Mount Pleasant PD, and specifically into the school tract. So under the current Central Mount Pleasant PD, this school tract is allowed two uses, the school or single-family residential. And obviously it's developed as the school, and so they want to bring this in and have it designated also with the school tract, and then they'd like to do the expansion for the loop for drop-off, as you heard Lee talk about. And there's an aerial that you can see the tract, and you can see the neighborhoods that were of concern. And the Planning Commission discussed this, and they were not against the fact that the school wanted to expand. The issue was that the neighborhood had not been engaged the way the Planning Commission thought. So they did recommend denial 6-2. And they kind of sending a message for the school district and for the applicant to speak to the neighborhood, which they did, as Lee mentioned last Thursday night. They had a meeting, and they have worked out an updated plan to where they'll accommodate pedestrian and golf carts and bicycles and extend that loop. And
Could you orient me on the ground here? Rifle Range is at the bottom.
Yeah, so Rifle Range, Hale Tract, or Hale Road right here, that's correct. And so there's not going to be an additional vehicular access off of Hale Road. It's just going to extend the loop to help get traffic, alleviate traffic off of Rifle Range.
Okay, so there are going to be no curb cuts.
Correct.
Okay. All righty.
Here's kind of a blowing of it.
Yep. Now, is that going to be rezoned institutional?
No, it's going to come in to the PD, and it's going to be zoned PD, the same as the school tract.
And it's going to be rezoned specifically into the school tract.
Yeah.
In the PD. So mm-hmm. It's not like the school could decide then the next day that they're going to do something else with it. It would be school tract.
Or
yeah.
Single family residential.
Which is what it already is.
Okay. That's sure. Correct. It's called, within the PD, it's called the Sloan tract or the school tract, but that's going to be the specific use. And it would go through staff level review. They would be required to have a buffer and all of those things. So those will be reviewed at the staff level.
And we cannot condition zoning. I think there was, in public comment, there was a suggestion that we lay some conditions on this, but I think we are not permitted under state law to...
You can because it's a PD.
You can, okay.
This is a PD amendment. So they're going from a straight town zoning into a PD. So with a PD, you can condition.
That we should include the specific condition requested by the citizens, which is that there will not be a curb cut on Hale Road. So I would like that included in there to protect them.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything else to do?
Could I just ask you a curiosity question? What's the acreage of that entire parcel?
The school tract, too?
No. Just the one.
It's just under 2 acres. 1.99 acres.
Can you go back to the image of, keep going. Okay, right there. Just hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
And just for clarification, they plan to bring us down and kind of extend, right. So it'll kind of do this sort of thing, so they can stack vehicles.
Okay, and then with any motion that's made, we will include the condition there that there be no curb cuts. The school was. Go ahead. Go ahead, Lee.
Technically, the plan shows a curb cut for the golf
carts. The golf carts, right.
Right.
And that was okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Vehicular access.
Okay.
Large vehicle.
Got it. And that's PD for those who are wondering, because the school property was donated by the area across the street.
Mm-hmm. So this is all part of the PD.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, do we have a motion?
Yes, I move to approve with the conditions as described.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion to approve with the conditions that were described. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Okay. So we'll move to Hale Road and text amendment.
The next few are text amendments that staff's been working on. The first two deal sort of with issues of smaller features that our code currently lists. Certain things are allowed to exceed the height, and the list is very specific. And so if somebody suggests, well, what about something that we didn't think of, but it's very similar to that, can, you know, what happens? And our interpretation is, because the list doesn't allow you to do that, we can't add other uses in terms of an exception. This amendment would permit that. So using and inserting such as but not limited to, staff has the ability to look at and say, this feature is similar to an X or a Y or a Z. It meets the intent of allowing certain things to exceed the height limit, and that would be acceptable. Likewise, in the opposite direction, the next text amendment deals with things that can be in the yard or the setback. The best example we have lately is you notice that the list doesn't mention generators, individual home generators, yet those have become more and more popular. And yet when somebody says, am I able, I can put other features that extend into the setback, but I can't put my home generator. I can have an HVAC unit, 4x4 and a pad, but I couldn't have a generator. The answer is, that's correct, you can't. This language change would allow us to accommodate that as a particular use. Planning Commission recommended both of those for approval.
Move to approve.
Okay. Both? Which one?
5D and 5E.
D and E, yeah.
Okay. So we have a motion to recommend approval of D and E.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay.
And then the last text amendment that we have for you is one that you reviewed at a prior meeting. We pointed out, as we gave you an update on the building permit allocation system and made a recommendation that we could shift and move 15 units from our single-family detached dwelling category into the accessory dwelling unit category. That was agreed to. This is the language that would actually do that. Planning Commission recommended approval as well.
Okay.
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve F. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. All right, six.
Okay, this last item was deferred from September, and it's Shermer Avenue. You can see there it is in the overlay. It's currently zoned NC neighborhood commercial, and the applicant is requesting to rezone the parcel from neighborhood commercial to R1 low density residential district. The comp plan does call for urban corridor land uses. So if you'll recall back when we had the text amendments for the urban corridor, one of those text amendments was to remove, if your underlying zoning is commercial, it removed the ability to do single-family detached residential. You can only do that if your underlying is residential. The applicant actually has permits that have already been issued to do some townhouses there. What he would like to do and what he feels like is more in character with what's across the street right here is single-family detached. And so in order to do single-family detached, he does have to rezone to R1. And this is what he would like to do, and here's a rendering. And I think he'd like to do two single-family detached residences for family members. And I don't think he's here today, but that's all I have unless you have questions.
How many townhouses would he have been able to?
I think he was going to do four townhouses.
So it's going from four residences to two residences. Okay.
And does this fit within the urban corridor desired uses, or is it preferred that it be more commercial in that area?
Preferred commercial mixed use. So the R1 underlying isn't necessarily consistent with the comp plan. It is consistent with what's going on across the street, general area. So.
But he does have permits for townhouses?
He does. He was ready to move forward with it, and he just has decided he would rather do the single-family detached. So.
I tend to be in favor. I'd like to make a motion that we approve.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second for recommendation for approval to the council. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, continued discussion of building heights and Johnny Dodds and Chuck Dolly portions of the overlay district.
We're returning from the last time you had a discussion on this. So if you remember, all the Boulevard Overlay District, we've shared with you several times, which shows the differing height, maximum height limitations throughout. We've been focusing on Johnny Dodds in the latest discussions. And so what you have existing today at the upper part of the screen is that the area within the middle is the 55-foot height limit in that lighter green, and then both ends anchored by 80-foot tall potential buildings in that purple fuchsia color down at the bridge end and up at East Cooper Hospital. And so there was a discussion or a suggestion at a prior committee meeting that maybe the 80-foot limits should go down to 65 feet. In the interim, staff has taken a look at existing buildings, the creation of nonconformities. If you take it from 80 down to all down to 65, and we came up with sort of a middle proposal for you to consider. So the central corridor stays the same. The area in gold would go to the 65-foot, and then only portions of the medical zone at the northern end and the hospitality zone at the southern end would remain at 80. So where we sit today at Town Hall, the sort of the central or the eastern part of this end, all the gold would be reduced from the 80 to 65, but only retaining the 80-foot limit here for some existing structures. Likewise, at the upper end, 65 would capture, but then, as we pointed out, for instance, the hospital itself is at 74 feet, becomes nonconforming, so that's where we suggested kind of a three-tier, 80 down to 65, 55 back up, and then back up to 80. And that's what we have for your consideration at this time. And then ultimately it would require formal text amendments to move forward if that's something that you want to do. So there's existing again.
So thank you very much for your work on this and for working to ensure that we're not creating a bunch of non-conforming properties with this. One of the things that I've been thinking about and reading about is that this concept of height limitations as opposed to story limitations is potentially one that we should be talking about, because with the height limitations, we get a very boxy architecture of companies wanting to jam as much as they can into that structure. We get the flat roofs. We get this sort of very boxy, uniform architecture. If we shifted our mindset to think more about the number of stories we wanted in these regions, and I know this is a much bigger discussion than this, but as we're talking about limiting the heights, this is something I wanted to raise, is it possible that we could maybe consider going to more a number of stories versus the number of feet to try and encourage a more diverse and interesting architecture?
Yes, bless you. It's something that we've been discussing too. And so is there a better way to get at dealing with these kinds of issues? Clearly you have to think about other examples where somebody would say, well, it's only three stories like you allow, but they're three 20 story floors that take you to 60 feet. So we'd have to be, I don't know that many people would really do that. In more instances, you have that ground floor level is taller than the upper floors, but we could definitely take a look at an additional discussion of how might we translate using feet and getting hung up on the number to maybe hung up on a different number, the number of floors or stories. We'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. Tom?
Man, this is the time that I wish I wasn't on the planning.
I see you've been pushing your hair back.
Yeah, it's not the only time. But, when I have a hard time making a decision in anything, I try to go to that thing that guides me to why. So if it's aesthetics, there's one reason. Height. Another is, for me, the ability to raise funds necessary to keep the town going. And I think 80, 65, 55, before the 80 was allowed, might have been a pretty good thing. We already have this now. I think we have people who have but they're in that 80-foot place expecting to build 80 feet because that's what it was when they bought it. I believe if we go back into them and we say, nope, we're changing it to 65, that may be what we want aesthetically, but those people are going to then say, wait a minute, this is what I got, and I think we open ourselves to some challenges on that. So I'm just cautious to see what that may be. The other thing is, and I think I made this comment at some public meeting, but the fact that we don't have a Boeing and we don't have a Volvo and we don't have any of that, but maybe 10 more feet is our Boeing. Maybe that's our way to get revenues into the town that we desperately need. And so I don't know. I wish we could turn the clock back and originally show that picture of 80, 65, 55, because that makes a whole lot of sense right there. But I wonder about the challenges that may come to us if we change heights of people that already either purchase property or are anticipating having something that we had before. That's my comment.
I agree that we may need to look at these things as stories as opposed to just straight height. And I don't want to create that wind tunnel effect when you come from Charleston into Mount Pleasant. And all of a sudden, it's like driving down into a valley. That happens at times in Charleston. I don't care if that's not what I would hope. That's not what we want for Mount Pleasant. And I think, to your point, Tom, there are people who have, that may need to be grandfathered. They've got a plan that they've got on that they've submitted, and we may have to do that. And then there's the shape and size of some of these parcels that, as I look at them now, I don't know how we're going to, other than go to stories, I like how we did it on Coleman Boulevard, but those properties were big enough that you could have 45 feet and then step it up, but it was deeper lot, and you know, you didn't see those real high buildings. But I think, you know, to make it more interesting, we don't want, you know, like come off the bridge and there's a big flat roof. Could you put some stuff together for us for that? You know, and this isn't a decision we have to make right now. And as a matter of fact, we need to get into the comprehensive plan badly and start working on that, getting it done.
Bless you, too.
We need to start getting that done. But there are some challenges, but we just, you know, we just don't want all that right through there. Okay.
We'll continue to look at that.
We'll continue. Okay. Dominion Energy. You guys are up.
Oh, no, we're not. Somebody else is there.
Oh, can you stay, did you say?
We're staying.
Oh, okay.
Just adjusted us.
Yeah. I started to say, certainly you can.
You
Hi, it's good to see you again. How are you?
Morning, maybe.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Right. I'm Jennifer Hightower with Dominion Energy. And you guys, thank you for inviting us to give you an update. We weren't exactly sure what you might want to know about our recovery efforts for Dorian. So we've prepared a presentation. We can be as detailed as you'd like us to be. We certainly can. You'll just lead the conversation. But I've got Bill Turner, our Vice President of Electric Operations, and Danny Cassis, our Vice President of Customer Relations and Renewables, to talk about undergrounding and then the recovery efforts.
Well, and you know, this is a continuation, I think, of the whole discussion of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with the tree effort, you know, that's kind of ongoing. And we really feel that it's the desire of a number of the residents of Mount Pleasant, in order to protect the trees, to have as much undergrounding done as possible. And at some point, we need to, I guess, turn our finance folks, pick them up by their heels and start shaking them to get some coins out. But we need to see what, you know, how we're going to approach undergrounding and how we can work together with Dominion to get that done. And I think a lead in with I know the numbers of debris, square yards of debris, thousands, tens of thousands of square yards of debris have been removed from the town of Mount Pleasant. And, you know, we know that interferes with electrical service. So this is, I guess, a combined discussion of, oh, and there's Marcy right there, and I was talking about holding her upside down. that how we're going to approach undergrounding, how we're going to work together to do that, and by doing that, save our trees. And we're getting more and more historic as every day goes by. So with that's how. I think. Is there anything y'all would like to add to that?
Well, I think you know, Dominion's it's a private company, and they've got to do their own cost-benefit analysis of the costs of this tree cutting, of the costs of maintaining these above-ground lines versus the cost of undergrounding them long-term for the future. So I'm certain if you have any information on that, that would be useful for us to kind of see where your calculation is and if there are certain areas of town that have experienced more outages or more kind of damage and cost to your company that could happen. I understand there's a desire for the town to participate financially in supporting these efforts of undergrounding, and I know that our citizens would love that. I would love that too, but you know, as Tom has said and as I've said and we're looking at right now, there's just not the dollars currently right now to do that. And we already have a laundry list of, you know, Medal of Honor Museum, adding 30 firefighters, you know, the county's taken away $1.75 million from us to add, you know, I mean, Harbor Accelerator wants $50,000 a year to exist in Mount Pleasant. So there's like kind of a lot of people kind of coming to the table with the hands out, and the pockets are not so deep. And so So I think understanding from you all what your plan is and what the ask would be of us in order to effectuate this, then we can take that back to our deeper budget discussions and help prioritize. Because I view this as part of our dealing with drainage and flooding, dealing with these power outages and with our citizens. And I think that's it's an important thing that we need to look at.
And it's also clearly something that our retreat in January, there's going to be some prioritization going on. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. I'm going to yield to Danny Cassis.
So have I thrown you a softball there?
You did.
Okay.
But a good one. I mean, it's right down the middle. So let me offer Danny Cassis, I know most of you. You called me 20 years ago during Floyd to chew me out because the power was out. So here, let me, this is hopefully ties into what you've stated, Councilman. So you have the current structure as it exists today. Which is, the framework is a franchise agreement. It's a contract between Mount Pleasant and Dominion Energy. And so the framework as it exists today is built around a concept called a non-standard service fund. Don't limit yourself to that as the only way to do what I think are public interest infrastructure projects. But think of that as maybe the starting point. Mount Pleasant has actually utilized that fund to the extent of about $8.5 million over the life of the existing agreement. It's probably more money that's been spent on infrastructure than any location or any jurisdiction we serve in South Carolina. So you already have a proven understanding of how that model works. Most of those projects were generally along transportation corridors, and they were shared projects. Mostly, Eric, you correct me if I'm wrong, but they're mostly were built around, I think, the creation of some aesthetics, but also mutual benefits to both parties. Well planned out, well thought of. The town did a really good job 15 years ago to say, hey, look, this is what we want to accomplish. And by that contract, we're obligated to the town to match the investment. And the money that the town uses is essentially money that comes from the fees that we collect in a franchise fee to use the streets and rights-of-ways in public places. So that match, that 50% match, that we're obligated to, we absorb that cost. That ends up ultimately in rates, but that's a structure that actually is a starting point. I would say Linda, you did a great job, by the way. So you are good at public speaking. I would say that it's important to prioritize. Neighborhoods are harder projects. They're complex. But we've done them. They just take more. You line up the three value props. You have to line up the value prop for the town. You have to line the value prop up for the utility in terms of the building the reliable energy delivery system. And then you have to line up the value prop for the people that live in the neighborhood. When those three parts come together, then you can do neighborhood projects too. My suggestion would be to look deeply at what are the things that you want to accomplish as the town on behalf of the people that we serve with the energy delivery system, and then we'll work on a methodology that works within your goals. So what we don't do as currently do is we don't set the prioritization for non-standard. The town sets that, dictates to us where their interest is and where that public interest is, and then we work that way.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Excuse me,
Dan. So basically, my interpretation of what you're saying is that Dominion has no plans to underground lines in neighborhoods in Mount Pleasant, that it would have to be initiated and supported by the town financially and, you know, administratively
in order for that to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, we're obligated for a 50% match, so we're essentially 50% of the partnership.
Right, but you're not going to initiate those projects. We have to initiate those projects.
Yeah, and okay. I will. I don't want to bore you with regulatory framework, but so principally we can't cost shift. I can't make somebody in another jurisdiction pay for something. You just had a great discussion about that annexation. It kind of, our models aren't that all that much different about what things cost. So there's some benefits that we derive. We recognize those benefits, but if we were doing a prioritization just based on reliability, then we would probably organize around just taps off mainline, and it wouldn't be necessarily entire neighborhoods. But I will not deny there's some benefit. There's also some, we get the risk with it too. Unfortunately, underground's not the, it helps on certain events, and then on other events, it's not as, you have outages too. And they take longer to fix. It's a good de-risk for an event that just took place. But it's not the answer. If you knew how many times Bill had to take a call from something that happened downtown, where there's already a lot of infrastructure that's underground, it's inundated by water, it's an electrical system, that's not the perfect answer either. It's a combination of those two. But good question.
Yeah. Yes, sir. I don't know if you can answer this, and it doesn't have to be super accurate, but just ballpark, the project that we had presented in front of us, what does that cost to bury those lines about?
So I'm not going to answer that question.
Yeah, I get that.
But no, that's a lead into an important thing, which is if everybody wanted to know what it cost, we would never get to actually doing anything. Mm-hmm. So, which is kind of why we asked for the prioritization, because I think you actually have the funds available in your non-standard service funds to direct us to do the actual more detailed design. Mm-hmm. And with that comes a fairly accurate or certain placement of equipment, which then gets you to the cost piece. So you probably followed some of the other stuff that we've done, you know, in some of the other jurisdictions. That's just get us to the starting point.
You're so good, Danny. is it $10 million? Is it $2 million? Is it? I don't have any idea what the cost is.
But I will describe it as it will be expensive because it's underground. It's not the same thing as the overhead.
Sure.
And we can provide kind of representative numbers, but I wouldn't want to
hire yourself.
Yeah, because I think you want accurate too, because I think people make decisions on their value props. Part of it is what they end up, if you end up doing it in a way that provides for a monthly fee, for instance, people want to know what that is.
Yeah.
We already know there's a price sensitivity. I can tell you that if it gets above a certain amount,
right,
the value prop goes away for the neighbor completely.
Right.
That's why I'm real cautious. And we did the same thing in Riverland Terrace, and I was begging them for 2 years, please, just appropriate the money to do the analysis, and then you'll get a real number.
Yeah.
But then some people, you know, they want to take and say, well, it's going to, if you don't want it, you just say, you take that number and say, okay, it was too expensive. I just like to go, I like to get something that you can, it's bankable. You can take it and you can say, hey, this is what it's going to be and this is where we're going to be. And then you're doing math backwards to figure out how to financially solve it to the best interest of the three parties.
I have a question.
Okay.
That franchise fee fund, is that a separate fund that the town keeps separate to support projects like this? And if so, how much is sitting in that fund, and are there any plans for the use of that fund?
Thank you. It's a part of our franchise fee with Dominion. Danny mentioned it's called a non-standard service fund. It's provision. It works a little bit like this. It's 1% of their gross revenues, and that can be the amount of a project that we'll have to match. So let's say their gross revenues are $100 million. 1% makes eligible a $1 million project, of which if we would point the way and they'd have to participate in half that cost, $500,000. We'd have to participate in the other half, $500,000. Historically, over the years, council, staff, we've targeted projects of large projects of great community importance, or benefit is a better word. Classic example is Mathis Ferry Road. What was it's a established scenic highway of the state. The overhead power lines were doing what you know to the trees, and the technology finally became available where you could bury the lines. And so they were required to take on 50% of the project, and so did we. And for years, we had to cobble the money to pull that together.
It didn't come out of that franchise fee.
There's not a dollar that comes out of that franchise fee. That is a requirement of participation. So so that 1%, that $500,000 isn't given to the town. We've got to come up with that money on our own. Historically, we've used money that's been paid, say, by developers who had to clear land and pay money into a tree bank fund. We would then take that money, put it towards something like this. That amount has run dry over the years as development has slowed down. So then we'll, if it's in a hospitality area, we can justify the use of hospitality tax revenue to do it, or accommodations tax revenue to do it. But either way, it comes from the town's coffers to satisfy it.
So this percentage then just creates an obligation on Dominion to come up with the remaining amount that we put in from our
yes.
dollars. So it's not actually, we don't actually get money from Dominion.
Right. And okay. We don't have the money and don't plan on having the money to reach all of the projects that have the most public benefit for this fund. So getting into specific neighborhoods would require a new identification of a revenue set to be able to reach it. And then I'm glad Danny mentioned it because they're much more expert in the subject than I am. But undergrounding power is not the silver bullet. I mean, if there's a pile of debris on the ground and it's run over by one of our crews, that neighborhood is likely to be down longer than they would have been if they just had an overhead line. And that happens, I think, frequently across the country. In addition, to get into individual properties, which are what are found inside of neighborhoods, it's a tough planning process because council would have to have the willingness to condemn potentially private properties where these boxes have to be stored. And that frequently is a hurdle that is too much to overcome when you're dealing with specific neighborhood projects.
Like nobody wants the box on their land.
Yeah. Or if it just has to be on this property and someone says no and you can't purchase an easement or whatever, then you have to take it if necessary. And that's usually, in my experience, where a lot of these projects have fallen.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to start the process to get to a point where we can say it's either too hard or it's doable. Because I think this is something that that the residents want. You know, I've always lived in area. Well, no, that's not true. Oak Haven had underground electric there, and we had the water intrusion, and they had to hunt for the place in the cable to splice it and all that. And I understand that. But I think we need to look out. Do we know what areas, if we could look at a map, we know what areas have overhead lines?
Several neighborhoods.
Okay.
Several.
And we already have those identified?
I'm sure of it somewhere.
Yeah, we actually prepared a map or have one prepared. Mm-hmm. So, and we can represent it. So that you can see and what it really looks like, and this is from my what I remember. Yeah, for the most part, older Mount Pleasant,
sure.
Exclusive of kind of the what I call the spine roads, or the roads that existed back when I went to college at Clemson in 1981. Those older neighborhoods are the ones, and then everything else that developed, you know, post a certain time period, which Mount Pleasant had 6,000 people in 1981. So pretty much everything else then started to follow a residential underground policy where developers picked up that cost.
Right.
So it looks like you could almost track it to the old boundary. I mean, in the end of the day, that boundary that existed back in the, you know, back in the 80s. But we should provide that map. Yeah.
Eric, I have another question for Eric.
Sure.
And you alluded to earlier that there are existing projects in this arena that would be for the greatest public benefit that exist but are currently unfunded. Is that correct? Like, are there projects that the department, you know, planning department has in mind for undergrounding or whatever we would use this money for that are not funded that would need to get to that before we get into the neighborhood level?
I'm sure. Forgive me, I don't have that information with me, but just our experience in the community is there are overhead lines in public areas that could take advantage of this provision. And the money for it keeps getting less and less.
Can we maybe get a sense of like what those projects would be? Because if we have to, you know, if there's something that's going to benefit the entire town and then there's just neighborhoods, you know, we kind of have to prioritize and say what comes first and how do we attack this methodically and get to everyone.
We've been working on the Mathis Ferry first phase. The second phase is still close to finished with design. So that's like from Muir.
Yeah, I think of it in three phases, 1, 2, and now really 3. So I know that's on the drawing board. And so we really take direction from, we probably have at least the list of stated projects to work on.
And we were looking at McCants, I think, as the maybe another future project, that corridor. I don't know that we've identified any beyond that point yet.
Yeah, but you guys you haven't done it in a way that is actually severely limiting, where in some places they have this queue where you get in a list and then that's the order, and they have really no mechanism to kind of move things along, and it's very, very prescriptive. You've essentially created the ability of council to at least make decisions around the order of what you want to do things, which is essentially defining what the public interest is. So the only thing I would tell you is that to Hobcall, because I've had conversations with them, tried to share as much. So they've done something that probably is a little different in that they've expressed an interest in, you know, financial participation exclusive of the match, the 50-50. So that's a little bit different, which is why I'm advocating that you define the public interest, but don't take that out of the equation. There are other ways. I've done projects in other jurisdictions where there are other ways that to create, you know, the funding mechanisms to make things work. I mean, at the end of the day, it's our capital. Some of it may or may not get reimbursed. And then it's our obligation essentially to maintain those assets forever. So we can line them up. We'll work on that really hard if you guys direct us.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to begin the process. I think this is important to the towns, to the residents, like I say, who have these overhead lines, for a lot of reasons, but, you know, tree protection being one of them. And there's a process, and I don't know that I know exactly, you know, how to kick this thing off, but sounds like we have the pieces that we can get in front of us that we can look at and start moving towards that, because I think Dominion's there ready, and we have to give you direction as to how we go forward. So the ball's in our court to do that. And as always, you know, it's a matter of money, and we're going to have to look at those things too. But I agree with GM that this is almost like flooding and you know, some of the basic services we need to make sure that are good and that we have less downtime. So I guess we will get back to you. We're going to start moving. Of course, we have an election in November. So things, you know, some things may change. But I think starting to move in that direction, and we have neighborhoods that want to be involved in it. So
I think from our standpoint, that in the immediate deliverables, we should make sure, Jeff, you guys have that map that shows the areas that are that differentiates different color shows overhead and then underground, and then maybe just a we keep a ledger. So when we send over the ledger that's got the amount of money that exists in the obligation, which is the right word. It's just the obligation. So historically, the town's gotten sources that from grants and other things to then create the match, which then drives us to essentially invest. So,
okay. So Marcy, yo, at some point.